we're interlopers right now. I mean, you can hear that some finches and a canary are more than a little peeved that we're in their space. Sorry, guys. But the marvelous thing about this space is that it's not a park or a nesting ground, but rather we're inside the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston, and we're at a retrospective of Massachusetts artist Mark Dion's work titled The Misadventures of a 21st Century Naturalist.
So already by using the word naturalist, it evokes a kind of amateur approach, perhaps, and a less academic, a less purely scientific approach. And so that's something I want to encourage. I'm always interested in looking at the contributions of amateurs and people who are not, you know, academics or professionals.
Dion brings what he calls the purity of an amateur's love to his work. He's an artist and a would-be archaeologist, digging through flea markets and fish markets, abandoned warehouses and the like, to create installations that ask us to ask ourselves, what do our human-created environments tell us about our relationship to nature? And yes, those angry finches and the canary are part of this installation, but we'll get to them in a moment. Let's instead begin with the bird's antecedents. Dinosaurs. Or rather, Dion's full-scale diorama of a child's bedroom in all of its primary colored Jurassic glory, titled Toys R Us, When Dinosaurs Ruled the Earth.
So what we're looking at is really a kind of period room from 1994, and it's a period room of a child's bedroom. And every aspect of that bedroom, the bed covering, the wallpaper, the toys scattering the floor, the rug, the slippers, are dinosaur themed. So just about every object in here reflects this kind of commodification of these long extinct beings.
So many kids fall in love with dinosaurs, and it's like, what is it about dinosaurs that makes them fall in love with it? But it is an entryway into the natural world for so many kids. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, dinosaurs are, you know, they're big, they're fierce, they're also extinct, so you don't have to be so afraid of them. We know that they don't share the world with us anymore. Kids are attracted by that power, but also that's tempered by the fact that they don't really have to worry about running into a dinosaur in the same way you maybe have to worry about running into a bear or tiger or something. That dinosaurs are from another world.
Before we move on, the other thing about this work that got me thinking was we've got... Is that SpaghettiOs, like dinosaur
it
canned pasta, at least?
Yeah.
Dinosaur shape. And you've got dinosaur cookies. So much of what your work does, it's not just a straight artistic representation of nature. It's sort of a challenging representation of our relationships with nature. I honestly had not thought about this before I saw those. I was thinking so much of a child's entryway into the relationship with the natural world these days is through the act of consumption, right?
Well, like, absolutely. And you know, that children are still guided through the natural world by stuffed animals, by cartoons of bears and lions and things like this. And we still, in the way that I think traditional people always had animals around them to teach them about survival and the forest. We have animals around us who may be artificial, maybe entirely constructed, but they are teaching us norms and behaviors in the same way that the animals in, say, Grimm's fairy tales or Aesop's fables are teaching us.
And what about Dion's own childhood? What was it about growing up in and around New Bedford that gave him such a love of the natural world?
That whole area is just marvelous in terms of its you know, the depth of history, the important architecture there, that it's a working city. It's still, you know, my mother worked in the textile mills, that they were still functioning. You had the fishing industry there, but also you still had farmland, active farmland all around. You know, I grew up with an apple orchard next to me, fields. My brother and I could get on our bikes and go to the, you know, go to the salt marshes or go to the ocean, go to abandoned old farms. You know, it was very much like the world in miniature. It was a fantastic place.
So tell me, what does this piece then mean to you?
This is a work, this is the New Bedford cabinet from a project called New England Digs, where I did three sort of archaeological investigations in three New England cities. So Brockton, Providence, and New Bedford.
Meaning you actually did digs, proper
archaeological digs. We did proper archaeological digs at very different sites. And in New Bedford, we dug the foundations of a building that was known as O'Malley's Tavern, which had been destroyed in a gas main leak in 1977.
And so the cabinet then contains the results of the dig.
Exactly. So we always heard that O'Malley's Tavern was quite a rough place. So we imagined finding, a pool table and all sorts of strange, difficult things there in the basement. And, you know, we found, of course, things going back to the 19th and 18th century, you know, these clay pipes, which, of course, are very common in digs in New England.
Little glass bottles.
Yeah, little glass bottles. Also, O'Malley's Tavern had previously been a pharmacy. You've got these bottle stoppers. You've got glass and bone buttons and clay marbles and lots and lots of ceramics. And of course, you know, New Bedford's a very harsh marine environment, yeah. So you have this presence of oxidation on everything. You know, time is taking its toll on these objects.
And so, I mean, when we look at this piece, what are we meant to see here with this?
So, well, that's interesting because you and I see this stuff all the time.
Yeah.
We are people who have this privilege of going behind the scenes. We get to see, you know, how the sausage is made in the culture industry.
Yeah.
Not everybody gets to see that. In fact, everyone gets to see an almost kind of sanitized version of this. So, there'll be a dig of thousands of objects, but the museum may only show the one masterpiece, the one object that tells this story, which is often the narrative of the ruling class in a way. And so this is meant to be very inclusive. You're meant to find yourself in this, but also yourself as part of a long continuity of history.
Now, have you worked with museums?
Very much.
Yeah. So tell me about that. Because it makes me think now that, you know, maybe I'm reflecting on something you just said a minute ago. Maybe they ought to pull that stuff back from the storehouses and put it in the display areas so we can see them and interact with them.
Well, that's what I think, too. I mean, when you're in a science museum, very often you are a passive consumer of information. When you're in an art museum, you are a critical appraiser of things. And I want to bring those two things back together. So that's really what this exhibition attempts to do.
Yeah. Fantastic. Now, we're hearing a lot of chirping.
Yes.
Should we go see the source of that?
Let's go see the source of that.
We turn a corner, and there, filling another room, something that looks like it's materialized right out of the notebook of a precocious child naturalist. A little Darwin-esque, but with whimsy. For there is a huge black cage, home to those quarreling birds. But closer inspection reveals more. Some books dangling from the branches of an old tree, antique pictures, and even some quotations.
Well, what we're looking at is an aviary. It's a large circular space that visitors can go into, and at the center of this is a pretty significant dead tree. And its branches spread out, and those branches are filled with books and objects. And in this aviary live 18 zebra finches and 4 canaries.
So we can actually go in.
Yeah, we can go in.
Let's do that.
So now we are in the aviary with the birds. And as you see, we can get very close to the birds.
Yeah.
And the longer you're in here, the more habituated they become to us. So, you know, it's not uncommon to be in here and have the birds land on you. But also I think what's really interesting and exciting to me is the more time you spend in here, you begin to recognize the birds are individuals. They are not, you know, they're not carbon copy wind-up toys. They have different kinds of behaviors. Some of them are, you know, some of them are bullies, and some of them are wimps, and some of them need to be in a group, and some of them are very individualistic. And you see that one was that there is gathering nest material. So I think that's what I want people to experience, is that kind of, we can have this proximity to them. We can see and enjoy ways that they're similar, but at the same time, they very clearly have a different set of priorities and a different way of seeing the world.
So, oh, there's so much to talk about this piece, because most of the time in the wild or even in a park, when you get close to birds, they rightly fly away. But here, right. Since we're in the aviary, and as you said, they can get used to us, they're not doing that. So it sort of heightens my sense of feeling like a true interloper into their world.
Yeah. This feels like their world, but also...
But it's not.
It's their
really.
World with our priorities.
Our stuff,
right?
Exactly.
It's surrounded by all of these books. And these are books that I believe would be very helpful for birds to know something about. You know, there's a whole section here about cats, and there are books on chemistry, and there are books on the history of natural history, and books on migration and geography.
I mean, you've got books about environmental ethics and our wild heritage and a portrait of Rachel Carson.
Right. Rachel Carson and Marjorie Stoneham Douglas and John Muir and a number of people who have made contributions to the idea of saving wild things in wild places.
Now, I have to say, I feel both just... This is like a really wondrous and wonderful space to be in. But when you use the word that the birds are indifferent to the sort of human materials surrounding them, it also made me wonder if you're saying that we're indifferent to some of the lessons and the thought and the thinking that are in the books here that you have.
I mean, that certainly would seem to be the case, right? That this information is equally available to us, perhaps even more available to us. And yet it still doesn't kind of resonate in our culture the way it could and should.
I love this space. So this is the first time that a collection like this of your work has been shown in the United States.
Yeah, this is my largest survey to date in the United States.
And what does it mean to you that it's happening here in Massachusetts?
Well, there's a lot of New England in me. I'm very much formed by some of the relationships to nature that I grew up with. You know, here, you know, my understanding of nature was never this kind of vast, untouched wilderness. It was always nature side by side with an urban context and a suburban context. And there's nothing pure or pristine about it. That doesn't make it any less nature for me. So when I think about nature, I'm not always thinking about wilderness. I'm thinking about something existing in our backyard. So that is very much forms the way I think about wild things and wild places. It doesn't have to be this model of the pristine. Yeah.
Well, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
And
for me too.
The work is absolutely remarkable. Thank you so,
Thank
so
you.
Much.
Thank you. It's really been fun.
Artist Mark Dion, his retrospective, The Misadventures of a 21st Century Naturalist, is on at the ICA through the end of the year. And of course, as much as I love radio, I've got to tell you, this is one you need to see with your own eyes. And we've got some information and some pictures to whet that appetite, especially pictures of that artful aviary. It's all at radioboston.org.